Right now, though, a call in for anyone who blogs or tweets about your illness or your health. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you blog or tweet about your health or your illness, we invite you to call in right now and do a little oral history. 212-433-9692. Tell everyone why you do it, what you choose to share, and why and what you think that does for you or your loved ones or your other readers. 212-433-9692. The reason I ask, as some of you may have figured out already, is the online firestorm that's been going on over two newspaper articles that raise questions about a woman who tweets regularly about the details of her battle with cancer, a woman named Lisa Adams at Sloan Kettering. She tweets at Adams Lisa. The articles were by Emma Keller of The Guardian and New York Times columnist Bill Keller, is her husband, yes, husband and wife newspaper columnist, wrote about the same woman with cancer 4 days apart, January 8th and January 12th. They had slightly different angles. But the pushback was fast and furious from cancer patients and others who felt their right to communicate and to manage their illnesses in their own ways was being questioned. One article questioned whether readers of these blogs or Twitter feeds would be more dignified if we turned away. That was in one of the Keller articles. The other compared the tweeting cancer patient Lisa Adams and her attempt to treat her cancer aggressively with one of Keller's in-laws' choices to die without the most aggressive treatment. My impression is that relative was probably a much older man. The tweeter is a woman in her 40s with three kids. So the pushback against the Kellers has been fierce. The Guardian even removed Emma Keller's piece from their site, which raises other journalistic questions, though you can find the piece elsewhere. And the web is all kinds of, you know, full of all kinds of pushback articles. If you just kind of search some keywords around this topic, you'll find pieces like, if you don't like people tweeting about cancer, don't read it. Guardian's in-house critic, divisive cancer column, shouldn't be restored to the website. What Bill Keller doesn't get, there is no right way to die. No shame. Bill Keller bullies cancer patient, The Nation. Gawker, dear Bill Keller, I have cancer. Is that okay? So you get a sense of what those two articles have generated in terms of angry response. But really, I'm not too interested in the debate over the Kellers either way, or what should or shouldn't be written, or what questions should be raised or not raised in prominent newspaper articles. For the sake of this call-in, or the ethics or the sensitivity-insensitivity of the journalism involved, I just thought that with all this going on, and many of you out there who probably do write publicly about whatever your health challenges are, probably being aware of this, I would let some of you who do blog or tweet about your health or your illnesses just call in and do a little oral history. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. I just want to give you voice here to tell everyone why you do it, what you choose to share and how you decide, and why and what you think that does for you or your loved ones or your other readers. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. It's a call-in for anyone who blogs or tweets about your illness or your health. 212-433-9692, and we will take your calls right after this. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we have a lot of people calling in who blog about your health or about your illnesses. So we're just going to go to the phones and hear some of you at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And, well, let's see. How about Amy in Manhattan? Amy, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you blog about?
Well, I have a blog called Boo Cancer, You Suck, and it's where I chronicled my own journey with breast cancer.
And why did you do that? Why did you set up a blog? Why did you title it that, since you shouted the title right out?
Well, I titled it that because the day that I was actually getting diagnosed, I kind of like blanked out for a moment. And the only thing I remember thinking was, oh, boo, this really sucks. And so then I thought, oh, yeah, I should start a blog about this. And then I kind of like, where am I going with this? And I had to snap back to reality for a moment.
Where did you go with it? Because that's a good first, you know, first reaction. Yeah, okay, cancer sucks. Everybody can agree about that. And then,
right. Then
what did you do?
Well, then what I discovered was that, you know, when you find out something like that, obviously there's people that you want to tell what's going on. And it can be hard to make those phone calls. And then it can be hard to process all the new information you're getting that's kind of scary and overwhelming. And then to keep reiterating it to people who really care about you, but like it's hard when you haven't fully digested what's happening and you have to keep talking about it. So I figured if I started this blog, initially it was a place I wanted my friends and family to go to on a daily basis and just kind of see where my head was at and what's going on. But then it really started to grow from there. And a lot of people that had cancer or had cancer and were in remission started to contact me, and it just kind of became something bigger than I ever thought it would be. And it was a really wonderful way to go through something so difficult.
It sounds like one of your motivations was so you wouldn't have to have the same conversation 50 times with all the people who are your friends and relatives. Is that
Yeah. Is
that part of what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Just because there's certain things that are pretty hard to think about, let alone talk about over and over. And so I felt like, you know, a good place for everyone to kind of turn to would be this blog where I would write everything pretty much as I was processing it or feeling it. It was almost like a journal in a way, you know, because on the blog I put pictures of everything I was going through and really chronicled my whole journey. So it's a place where people I knew could follow along and keep up to date on what was going on. And then if they had any other questions beyond that, obviously they could get in touch with me. But it was also a place for people who have relatives that had cancer to kind of really get a little bit more of an understanding of what it's like to go through that.
Doing this on Tumblr, which is so image friendly, have you included images or is it just a text blog?
No, it's lots of visuals as well. I really, you know, and some of them I had to put little warnings on. Like at one point I got a bone marrow biopsy and did a video of it.
Why?
Because that's just a part of my journey. It's a choice I made. You know, I documented the whole thing, and I really wanted to show. At the time, I was 31 when I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and you know, I really wanted to show what this whole process was like. I mean, on the blog, you see when I have hair, you see the moment my hair started coming out, you see me having to give myself shots in the stomach, or you know, it's part of whatever I'm going through with treatment. And I just think it's important because, you know, we all know that obviously cancer sucks and it's a bummer and it's a horrible disease, but we don't always know what someone actually has to go through.
Did you follow this whole Keller thing and the pushback at all?
And the what? I'm sorry?
The pushback to these articles in the Times and the Guardian, or is this the first you've heard of that?
Oh, no, this is the first. I just had a friend text me and say that that you were talking about people who block about their illnesses.
Yeah. Good. Well, yeah. I'm glad you called. Thank you very much. Good luck.
Thank you. Bye.
Amy at Boo Cancer You Suck on Tumblr, B-O-O Cancer Letter U Suck on Tumblr, that blog. Get some pickup on Tumblr from what we could see. Paula in East Brunswick, you're on WNYC. Paula, thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you for having me as well. I relate so much to the last caller because I too had breast cancer and decided to, you know, I didn't make an official blog. I did this kind of mass email and I sort of called it a blog. I think I was afraid for other people to see what I had written until it was all over. And now I've turned it into a book and it's called The Year I Lost My Breasts and Got Some New Ones.
You just call it to plug your book? No, I'm kidding.
No. I haven't even published it yet, so no, I'm not plugging anything. But I do want to, I just, you know, the point of kind of that title is, I think what I did when I was writing was to really sort of infuse humor in the whole thing, which really helped me. I wrote a lot with a lot of irony and kind of made fun of myself and made fun of the process as I was going through it in a way to sort of help me get through it. And at the same time, people were able to see that I was okay.
Somebody sent me a link to what looks like a really, really great site called, of all things, Cancer is So Funny. And it's a blog by somebody who, it's actually a book and a blog by somebody who has or had cancer and wanted to find the humor in it, you know, as you say, is part of what you did. So I'm looking at one of the cartoons on the site with the caption, "I feel kind of skinny," you know, because, you know, and it
that
just
was a little bit of a perk. I talked about being able to lose weight without having to go on any difficult diet. You know, the pounds kind of fall off because nothing tastes good and you have no appetite and, you know, the chemo is messing with your stomach and the nausea. So, yeah, I mean, so, I think there are ways to sort of find those funny pieces in it and to move forward. And I think the other piece was that from the very minute I was diagnosed, the first question that anybody asks is, am I going to live? And I think I was given pretty much the assurance that I was going to live. I was stage 2, and it was early, and I was treatable. And I think it's so much easier to have that kind of attitude when you know you're going to live. So that's a big difference. I think that if my diagnosis was terminal, I think I would have had a much harder time. I don't think I would have been writing anything quite so witty.
I guess not. Did you follow this Guardian Times thing? Were you aware of it at all, or is this the first you've heard?
You know, I read the Times all the time, and I'm trying to. I didn't catch what you said in the beginning of the show, so I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to.
Oh, okay. Well, it was an op-ed by, I don't know if op-ed's the right word, or an essay, or an op-ed by their columnist, Bill Keller. I think it ran in the 13th of January print edition on their website. But I'm not going to re-get into it. I said we're not doing this to have that debate. It's just that if you were aware of it and had some reactions to it, you know, I would have been curious. But, Paula, thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And let's go next to Eliana in Scarsdale. Eliana, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
And you blog about an illness?
I do. My blog is Punchy Mommy Believe in Life, and it's my journey with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I was diagnosed when I was 31 in October of 2012.
And so why did you decide to do this?
Well, unlike the previous blogger, no one ever told me that I might die, but I believe I was dying when I was diagnosed, and there was nothing funny about what I went through. And I was largely incoherent during treatment, but shortly after treatment, I started to feel a lot of anxiety and depression and a lot of PTSD symptoms. You know, I was like replaying images or situations that I went through. And so I started blogging to release them and to kind of get them out into the world and just, you know, let them go. And it really has helped me heal.
Do you care who reads it?
In the beginning, I didn't care, but now that I, you know, have been in remission for almost a year, you know, the aftermath of cancer is really difficult, especially for a young adult. And, you know, I'm kind of getting into some darker areas. And so sometimes I think before I publish something, because, you know, I don't want my mom to get too upset and, you know, I don't want my relatives to really get too upset, but it's, you know, something that I'm dealing with. So I usually just kind of put it out there regardless.
And do you expect to continue to do this throughout your treatment?
Well, so I've completed treatment, but I think recovery, the emotional scars are going to take a really long time to kind of fade away. And so I foresee that I'm going to be doing this for a long time.
Thank you, Eliana. Good luck.
Thank you.
And Lori in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lori.
Hi, thank you. I actually started writing. I was diagnosed 2 years ago with stage 3 breast cancer. My twins at the time were 3 years old. All of my family lives far away, like in Louisiana, Portland, Oregon. And when I told them about my diagnosis, I basically said, you have 48 hours to tell any other family members that you want about this before I post a notice on Facebook. And when I posted it on Facebook, it was more not to just, you know, tell my story. It was more because my family lives in South Louisiana where there's lots of gossiping, and I didn't want them to have to deal with people all of a sudden saying, oh, Lori's dying of cancer. We hear Lori's cancer. It was a way for me to tell them what I'm going through and what was actually happening.
So it wasn't only a way to communicate your own story, it was a way to control your own story.
Exactly. And then when I started that, as I started continuing it on Facebook, it turned into the blog and then turned into what I have now as the website is badrightbreast.com. And I actually had my documentary friend follow me through my entire process, which we videotaped from the doctor actually telling me the results of my pathology reports, going in with me for my mastectomy, going in through radiation and chemo, at home having my three-year-old girls shave my head. And so it helped not only my family, but also friends. It helped friends of mine who are in the medical industry who deal with patients to let them understand what's happening from the patient's point of view. And throughout all of it, I continue to say, this is my story. This is my diagnosis. Each person is individual. What happens to me may not happen to you. Everybody is unique and individual.
I don't think we could prove this scientifically, but do you think in any way it helps you heal?
It does, in fact, because it I actually do. I think getting it out, getting the words out on paper, what Amy said at the beginning is not having to completely rehash it over and over again. People can go and read it for you. People were wanting to know how to help. You were easily being able to tell them how to help. And I have to actually say, at the end of my, when I finished radiation, I did 4.5 months of chemo and 6 weeks of radiation. I was felt like I was mentally fine throughout all of it, and when I was done with radiation, it was the most depressed I had ever been. Because you constantly feel like you're doing something, and then between that time when you're not doing anything and when you're officially told that you don't have cancer anymore, it's that waiting game all over again. So being able to write through that helped get through that depression.
Do you read other people's cancer blogs? I think one thing we're learning from this segment, because our lines lit up right away, and you know, we could spend the next 4 hours on this if we had the time, just going through caller, 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 caller. People are doing this. Do you read other people's cancer blogs?
Yeah, because there are times when you feel like this is only happening to you. There are times when you feel like you are so alone, and in reality, you have to take a step back, you have to get out of your head, and you have to remind yourself, this has happened to many women before, this is happening to women now, and this is going to happen to many people afterwards. And so reading other blogs reminds you of that. And the op-ed and the Times, you know, I mean, I took it with a grain of salt, all of it, because people are going to judge no matter what. You know, even when you're going through cancer, you have this big perspective of life, of being on the subway in New York or walking down the street, and this idea that no one around you has any idea what you're going through. And then you start looking at other people in different ways, thinking, well, now that I look like cancer, that I'm completely bald, you get these looks, and you start realizing you have no idea what cancer has done to that person, whether they cared for someone or saw someone die or whether they went through it, you know. So it makes you have a different perspective on life.
Did you feel judged by the article? Because he might have said that he didn't intend to judge anybody's choices. He said that explicitly about the blogger and tweeter who he wrote about, just that some people do it in a different way, like his father-in-law who chose not to fight so aggressively. I doubt that he'd question you, diagnosed at age 36, you know, doing everything you can medically to fight the cancer.
You know, it's a person's opinion. I mean, you can't, it affects everyone in different ways. And so I think judging people for the way that they react to it is just not right, because it is going to affect a person. Each person is going to be affected in a different way. And how someone wants to tell their story, you know, and how someone is going to react to that, that's kind of why we're all here.
Lori, thank you so much, and good luck.
Thank you. Thank you.
Michael in Hell's Kitchen, our first male caller in this whole segment, and to talk about, I think, a very different kind of health or illness blog that he maintains. Michael, thank you very much for calling. You're on WNYC.
How are you doing, Brian? I appreciate it, and I've been on your show before. I'm really concerned with, you know, my narrative not being crowded by, you know, the American public, you know, or the government or all of these entities that hide the narrative of those going through maladies. And I'm being really particular as far as like those going through war and readjustment. So I've taken away a lot of my blogs because I don't want, you know, negative effects in regards to employability. So that's another issue that we don't really look at.
You were at war. You came back from one of the wars, and you have been blogging about that, the long-lasting effects of that on you. Am I understanding you right?
I've been talking about, you know, the different struggles regarding readjustment and the medical issues regarding war and the home front. And also, you know, this whole thing about having a voice, because it's very important for those going through not just, you know, readjustment from war, but, you know, much like the piece pointed out, you know, there's an issue of being able to kind of survive in this, you know, weak, debilitating state. And that's not all that popular in our society. So, you know, I just think it's important to have these voices out there. Now, I know, you know, Columbia University and a couple other places have these narrative medicine programs, and they're fantastic. And I know Yale School of Medicine, I will
I didn't know about that. What does that mean, a narrative medicine program? Helping patients tell their
research program up at Columbia University focusing on getting the stories out there from those who were ill, you know, so that person who had written the article, as well as people like myself, we can kind of like have our voices out there circulating and not have a doctor give our voice, not have a general give our voice, not have an organization give our voice, like a dominant veteran organization that has hegemony over the voices on other veterans. You know, we can put our voices out there through the internet, through, you know, paper, what have you.
So I think I hear a tension that you're grappling with as a vet dealing with whatever ongoing health effects you're dealing with, which is that on the one hand, you want to control your narrative and you want to have a public narrative and put it out there. On the other hand, you're the first caller to raise a concern about employability when people see that you've been struggling with whatever. So how do you resolve that?
Well, I just continue to pursue what I pursue in regards to my treatments, but at the same time, I'm also encouraging others to not just present their narratives according to, like, people in the media or the government or what have you want you to present your narrative, but to let the narrative flow. And not only that, for the narrative to kind of like present more questions to society. You know, I think that's the other important thing. I think, you know, in many ways, you know, we're told, you know, tell us your war story. Well, hell, you know, I want you to hear what I'm going through right now. You know, I don't want to be seen in Restrepo and then the story stops. You know, my appointments day to day, as well as managing my work schedule, picking up my son, doing all these things, that's important in my readjustment and my health reintegration. So I think it's important to look at multiplicity, and I really appreciate you letting me have this voice, you know, and not having like an organization or, you know, a hospital kind of like determine.
Speak for you. Michael, yes. Thanks again for your service in Iraq. And thanks for calling up and saying what you said today. All right, let's do one more, and we're going to do one. We did somebody coming from a little different place, Philip in Wayne, who told our screener that his girlfriend talks about her illness all the time all over social media. Philip, did I get that right?
Yeah. My girlfriend, she has a POTS. It's a postural orthostatic tachycardia. It's what we would call an invisible illness. She looks fine. You know, it's not like cancer where you can see she's ill, or it's not like something else where you know and people are aware.
Sometimes you can with cancer, sometimes you can't, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I understand. But at least you know. So with POTS, it's a rather large community, actually. It's not just her. There are groups on Facebook, but she has something on Tumblr called POTS Problems, where she communicates with her other people who are sick. And there's a lot of solidarity in this group of theirs, because a lot of people on the outside don't really understand. Because you'll see and you imagine, well, she looks okay, but really, like, getting up in the morning is a struggle. Like, I was going to tell her to call, but she's still in bed, and I wanted her to have this voice. I wanted her.
So you're representing her. How about for you as her boyfriend, seeing her stuff all over social media? Do you ever cringe? Do you ever yearn for your or her privacy? She's making her own choices, so she can yearn for her own privacy, I guess, if she chooses to. But how about you as a third party in this?
I feel immensely proud of what she's done. It's a very difficult situation she's in, because POTS is rather debilitating. I had never heard about it until we had gotten together and she had told me. And as it progressed, I've seen how awful it can be.
A heart condition? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's a heart condition. It heavily affects your blood pressure and a host of other bodily functions, where standing up too quick, you know, makes you fall over. Just a host of different things, where it just makes life incredibly difficult. Getting up in the morning is difficult. Going to work. A lot of people who have been diagnosed with POTS really can't go to work, so a lot of them are on disability. As it gets worse, a lot of people just become bedridden for majority of their time.
And so what?
Completely able people just have to stay home.
What does she get in the long run from blogging it?
Being able to talk to someone else, being able to find people who have the same issues, is, I think, really important to her. And I think it's important to everyone who has any kind of disease or issue where someone else can't appreciate what's going on with you. It's like meeting family members you've never had. It's like finding a sister you've lost a long time ago, I think. Because we found someone recently close by who also suffers from POTS, and she was really excited over that, to be able to share mm-hmm. her problems with someone in person. And I guess that's important about it, too, is that community. It's not just being able to talk about what's wrong with you, but being able to talk to someone else when something's wrong with them, and then you can be there for them. And
yeah,
that's what's important.
What a great side benefit for a disease that's pretty rare, to find somebody near you and then get together in person as well. Philip, thank you very much for chiming in. And that's where we're going to leave it. As I said, we could go for hours on this if we had that time, because so many of you want to share what you blog or tweet or otherwise share publicly about your struggle with an illness. So you can continue the conversation on our website if you want at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Feel free to post a link if you want people to go to your site and read what you're writing, or to your Twitter feed or whatever, and you can join the conversation that's there at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Again, thanks to everybody for opening up and for your phone calls. Still to come, or coming up next, we will talk to Tim Harford from the Financial Times, a.k.a. the Undercover Economist. Stay with us.